So anyway, it's awesome that so many people are here. I'm going to talk about half of the session, and the idea is that other people will kind of come in and bring some opinions. I've invited a few friends who I know will say interesting and controversial things. But the floor is open to yeah, no pressure, guys. Who will say incredibly insightful, novel, things, but the floor is open to everyone, of course, to participate, and also I think even I'd be very happy if we kind of stop and start. So if people feel like, wow, you know, either I'm totally disagreeing with that, or I'm like, there's something here we have to talk about, maybe just raise your hand. We'll kind of, if it gets too much, we'll I may start ignoring the hands, but otherwise, it would be great to have more of a conversation and really make this interactive, right? South by Southwest interactive. There is a tweet, a Twitter hashtag. It's SXP2PU. And Audrey here has volunteered to keep an eye on that. And so if people want to ask questions that way or make statements or something, that would be awesome. I would love to see the comments afterwards also. I will have a look at them. And so if you have kind of things you want to add or links or work you do that you want to bring into the discussion, please do. So topic of today is, when I submitted this session, I was thinking about some of the work that we do at the organization that I work with, which is called Peer-to-Peer University, P2PU short. And the world has completely changed since then. So when I was thinking of massive online learning communities, I had some ideas of what I was going to talk about. After I submitted the proposal, a few other people got into the game and ran massive online learning communities. And so I'm going to kind of talk through what's happening in the world of education and related to some of the things we've been working on, some of the ideas that we've developed, but really kind of try to figure out together what, you know, what's going on here and what does it mean for education. So a few words about P2PU. We are a nonprofit organization in the United States, but we really are just a community-driven learning innovation project. We run a platform that anyone can use. It's open source for social learning, so you can take the source code and run it yourself, or you can use our hosted version. You know, people have offered courses on a wide range of topics. But what's, I think, the most interesting thing about P2PU, and I may be biased, is there's a community of people there that really care about learning and education and what that could look like in the future. And their starting point is not the institution. Like, their starting points are interest-driven learning experiences that they've had as youth, open-source software communities. You know, they think of learning not from the institutional education side, first and foremost, but they kind of come at this from this other angle. So I think that's the most interesting about thing about us. We have three really core values: peer learning, community, and open, and they underpin everything we do. And we basically ask questions about what could this education future look like. Right? We ask questions like, how could you offer online courses that are engaging and kind of pull people in and scale in ways that, you know, people are, I think, have been struggling with in the past. We ask questions about certification and recognition of achievements. We are trying to figure out right now, I think assessment is really one of the most interesting things to look at. You know, how do you assess what people have learned? But anyway, let's get back to the topic of the conversation. So there's this wave of massive online courses that has kind of captured the public imagination, but certainly people in the academy. I think we've had massive for a while, right? So we've been able to, for example, there's a Stanford course on iOS development that's been downloaded over a million times. There's the famous Walter Lewin lectures at MIT OpenCourseWare. So I just had a look at this yesterday, almost a million views, and probably with translations and, you know, remotely hosted things, certainly more than a million times as well. MIT OpenCourseWare, Steve can talk more about this, but they estimate that they've reached 125 million people in some form or other with their materials, right? So it's massive on a just completely unimaginable scale for education. And we've been really good at scaling massive up to the distribution of content. Like, we can produce content and then we can push it out to people and we can reach huge audiences. And what's changed with these two guys, and not just with them, I'll come back to that later, is that we're now starting to scale learning and certification and assessments. And the ambitions are as grand as they were with the content projects, right? So, you know, 100,000 people, maybe 1 million people, you know, it's kind of in the realm of possibility now. And I have noticed that a lot of people who are kind of leaders in this space wear interesting shirts and jackets. And I don't know if that's my sample isn't large enough yet, but it's one of my major research questions for the next year. So what I want to do quickly is kind of what's happening in this space out there. What does it mean? And then what do we do? Like, if we are interested in education or technology or learning in institutions, outside, you know, what is this? What are the opportunities for us? What are the things we want to keep in mind? So I should ask, how many of you are pretty familiar with, like, for example, the Stanford AI course? Like, how many of you have looked at that course, maybe participated? Okay. How many, or any of the other courses like that, machine learning, like, you know, the Udacity stuff, Coursera? Okay, well, that's great. Because I do have the slides, I just didn't want to bore the audience to death. But since a few of you haven't seen them, I think it's worth kind of skipping through. So what has happened, right? We've got technology. We have an abundance. We have technology. We have networks to connect computers to each other. We have an abundance of open tools that we can use to communicate with each other, to create, to share. And we've evolved kind of collaboration mechanisms that include very large communities of people that coordinate sophisticated and complex projects over the internet. And they build really amazing stuff online together, like Wikipedia. So for me, that's kind of the starting ground for everything that comes after this. So there's been a few people in the education space that have experimented with something that they call MOOC, a massive open online course. And the first people, actually the pioneers, I'm not going to talk very much about, were people like George Siemens and Stephen Downes and David Wiley. And the idea was really just they were teaching courses in institutions, and what would happen if you just put all of the stuff that you did in the course online and you didn't put a password-protected site around it. And that was their basic interest. George Siemens and Stephen Downes have kind of more of a pedagogical approach to this. They want to find out how people learn. I think David Wiley is more of a pragmatist. He just kind of wanted to see how can he scale what he does and had an interest in the experience. And so this has really been the starting point. And then other people started paying attention to this. And there's been a wave of courses in the last few months that have really taken it to the next level. The two that I think are most widely known are the Stanford Artificial Intelligence course and the Stanford Machine Learning course. There was also a database course. There's a whole range of courses that Stanford offered. They're basically a series of videos that the professors have recorded. They're placed online. There's no charge. Anyone can sign up. There's kind of a weekly structure of smaller assessments and then larger assessments. And students could sign up online, you know, join this large community of other learners, download the videos, watch them at their own, you know, whenever it was convenient, work through the materials. And I think the amazing and kind of surprising success of this has been that the artificial intelligence course signed up 160,000 people. And I think roughly 25,000 of them, maybe you guys have the exact numbers, but roughly there, completed the whole thing. And a Stanford-level artificial intelligence course is a hard course. So I think there was just this kind of, you know, people took this idea of moving stuff online, they tweaked it a little bit, and I think the success was somewhat unexpected. Right? But now, so there was this response, right? These courses attracted a huge, huge audiences. So at Stanford, just a few words of what's happening there now. It was started as a project that was funded by the president's office. And these two kind of are actually good examples for the courses and the direction that, that's happening at Stanford is Sebastian Truhn, the guy on the right at the top, he started a for-profit startup called Udacity. So he's building out a computer science curriculum now. He left Stanford. He'd actually decided to leave Stanford before this, but it coincided with the success of this course. So they're building up an entire computer science curriculum on Udacity, which is the name of his company. And then the two people involved in some of the other courses, they went and started a company called Coursera. Udacity, actually I can show you the screenshot. So this is just going to be computer science. They have an interesting business model that they are going to... So in they're going to address a challenge for companies who are trying to hire good software developers, right? It's difficult to hire good software developers. The recruiters are charging very, very high fees, and often you're not totally sure what you're getting until the person has actually started and you get to work with them. And so the cost of hiring is extremely high because it may not work out. And so their business model is that if they have 160,000 people come through their course, 25,000 finish, they're going to take the top 1% of this group, and they're going to offer the data that they have on those students to potential employers, and they're going to charge for that. So if you're a tech company in the Silicon Valley, you want to hire an amazing artificial intelligence person, you can go to Udacity, or you will be able to go to... So this is somewhat speculative, I should add. I don't sit on the board or am involved with them in any way, but it's what people are saying. You will be able to go there and say, I want to hire a software developer, I'm willing to pay $20,000, and they'll basically give you a range of people that you could hire. So they'll become a recruiter for the tech industry. Coursera has a very different model. They are not going to just build that content themselves. They're becoming a platform, and they're reaching out to other institutions, and actually often, I think, to individual professors at those institutions. And they're trying to get them to run courses on Coursera, and with the promise that you can reach 100,000 students, you can build up your profile. It's a completely new way of thinking about your role as a lecturer or professor. And so they're currently working with three institutions. They've run into some. They were going to launch more courses, and they ran into some intellectual property questions with those institutions. Not all of the institutions were entirely happy to see their best faculty, often their most visible faculty, go to a for-profit startup again and move their courses onto these platforms when it's uncertain who's going to own the content that's on the platform. Would the institutions have to pay for accessing the content that their own professors are putting up there? So they're working through that at the moment. It remains it's kind of too early to see where this will go. The big kind of new announcement that came in December, and everyone's been paying a lot of attention to this, is MITx. Steve can talk... Steve cannot talk about MITx. So the idea of MITx is kind of... I think there's a number of motivations for MIT to come into this space. One is certainly that they've been a leader in open education as an institution for a long time, open courseware, and changed the playing field 10 years ago. And they're seeing that there's another opportunity to do something now, and they want to be a part of it. I think also the fact that they made a very clear statement that all their stuff is going to be open, so their platform is going to be open source, and they believe in openness, and is a signal to other institutions and professors that if they want to get involved in these MOOCs, you don't have to go to a for-profit startup and work with them. You have an open alternative. And maybe even your institutions will offer you this alternative. So, I know Georgia Tech is thinking about doing some MOOCs, so, maybe they'll adopt the MITx platform. I think Yale would be a great institution to look at some of these MOOCs, and there are some people here in the room who can speak more about that. So MITx is open. Interesting also, they're the first one. Stanford had kind of a certificate tied into the first courses, but MITx is the first one that's made a clear commitment to setting up a separate business entity, a nonprofit organization called MITx, that will give certificates for people coming through these courses. So they're not going to be MIT credit or MIT certificates, but they are going to be MITx, so they do have some of that branding and reputation rolled into them. And the commitment or the statements have been that the quality and the level of difficulty in these courses will be equivalent to what the students at MIT are working through. And in fact, what maybe one of the other motivations I should have mentioned earlier is this is actually an effort to bring these kinds of ways, tools of learning and education into the MIT system. So the foremost audience are MIT students for this. It's kind of the flipping the classroom idea that Khan Academy is doing at K-12. It's how can you make the university experience for university students who are at your institution richer using technologies like this. And we have some people in the room who are experts for that kind of stuff who are already doing that. And I'll show you a picture of them in a second. So just kind of the scale of this that this has reached, which I think is often what the people are drawn to first to kind of look at these numbers. So there's three Stanford courses here. The largest one had 160,000 signups with about 25,000 complete. The machine learning course kind of you can see, you know, it's a fairly small percentage that completes these courses, but it's still a huge number of people in absolute numbers. And then the only reason why there's no blue thing at 6002, it's the first MITx course. It hasn't completed yet, so they don't know yet. But they've hit 100,000 users signing up. So the numbers are gigantic, right? So a lot of attention has been paid to this part of the MOOC universe. But there is this almost parallel reality of people who have been innovators in this space for a long time in some cases and who are doing really amazing, interesting stuff, but are kind of flying under the radar a little more. And so, for example, Jonathan Wirth is a professional photographer, but he also teaches this course, two photography courses at undergraduate level at Coventry University. And he gets, in the tens of thousands of visitors to his courses. He teaches it to a few hundred students that are enrolled, but the participants, the audience of people who participate and submit stuff is much, much larger. And he invites professional photographers into this community and give presentations and talk about their work and help him frame some of the assignments. Really opens up the whole process of how you would teach photography at a university, right? That now it's really learning to become a photographer in the world out there, which is the best way to become a photographer. This guy here is pretty infamous, Jim Groom. He's not as scary as he looks on this, but he's kind of the poster boy for EduPunk. He might not like that, but... he's been running a course together with Alan Levine and a few other people called Digital Storytelling 106, DS106. Highly recommended to check that out. It's kind of become this alternative reality almost. So the last time he ran it, he set up this persona, Dr. Oblivion, and he played the professor. Dr. Oblivion was the professor of the class, and he kind of entered this persona. He actually shaved his head in the middle and kind of just went totally overboard with it, to be honest. And he ran this almost like surreal digital storytelling thing. And the amazing thing is it's attracted not only people from other universities who are running courses that can tie into this, so that there's, I think, four or five other university courses now that are using some of his materials and that are connecting into this in some way. But there are thousands of other people who are participating who are not enrolled in these universities, and they are assigning all of the they're developing all of the assignments. So the community creates the assignments. They are reviewing each other's work. It really has become this community of sharing digital storytelling experiences that goes way beyond what Jim and his colleagues would ever be able to teach in just one institution with one class of students. Really innovative stuff. These two guys, a guy and a young woman from Virginia Tech, they were speaking earlier today. I unfortunately missed it. I hope many of you saw it. I caught them at the EDU conference before and found out a little bit about their work. Similar kind of setting, I'd say, really pushing the boundaries of what's possible. They're teaching a course, a face-to-face course, to 3,000 students. And tying that into an online community of other people who can participate. So it's totally open to the world. Even if you're not a student, right, you can look at all the lectures. I think you can even participate in the office hours, or yes, you can participate in the office hours. So it's like open to the world, right? It's part of the global learning community, but at a scale that people hadn't really ever tried to do before, and doing amazing stuff. And right, so like, I guess the point I'm trying to make about all of these projects is they generally use off-the-shelf open source software, or at least free software, right, that is accessible to all of us. We can just take those tools. They exist. They're reliable. They're robust. They're easy to use. They open themselves up to the world. So there's no more that strict boundary. You have to log into your Blackboard system with your username and password, and everything is locked down, and it doesn't exist anymore. Just throw open the doors. They invite people in, and they're getting people in. So in this course, World Regions, they also are able to attract amazing participants and speakers, right, who maybe otherwise, if you run a geography course with 25 students, you know, a Nobel Prize winner isn't going to come to your course. But if you run a geography course with 3,000 students and, you know, tens of thousands of people watching online, you know, maybe someone, you know, at that caliber will come to your course and will speak about their experiences. So, you know, really amazing stuff. So I guess, so I wanted to set the stage with these two examples. There's the Stanford, MITx, you know, that one world, which is really trying to scale mostly engineering and technical courses to much larger audiences than we've seen before. And then there's the people who are already doing all this stuff, innovating, you know, coming up with new ways of doing these things. And I think there's a much larger community than we actually suspect. Like, I'd never met you guys before this conference, right? I'm sure there's, you know, there's probably a few dozen other people who none of us have ever heard of who are not connecting into this community. So things are moving. And so what does this mean for the university, for the lecture, for anyone interested in education? So Sebastian Truhn, he basically said, you know, after this experience, he cannot go back to Stanford. I mean, I said before, he left Stanford for other reasons, I think, or different timing. But this experience of having kind of being someone who can reach 160,000 people with things you deeply care about, then you kind of have to go back and you're sitting in your lecture hall and there's, you know, 50 people, or I think his course at Stanford was probably about 250 people. But, you know, you've got 250 people. Maybe it's not quite as exciting, you know, as being out there on the web with, you know, these huge audiences. So he said, you know, I'm not going back. And I think other people are going to go in that direction, and they're going to struggle with the constraints of the traditional model. This is kind of the other side, right? This is I'll talk about Reddit and what that is actually in a little while, but. There were these people who were taking the courses, and there was a lot of really strong language in those communities where people said, you know, we're not willing to pay for the university anymore. We're getting this stuff for free. It's top quality. You know, I'm learning the things that I want to learn. And, you know, we're sick of the university kind of overcharging us, locking down their content. And so I'm just reflecting some people's opinions here. I was getting a little too excited there. Just to show that there is a big shift, and another very insightful and intelligent young man who was sitting next to me on the bus over here. Said something that I thought kind of captures this is, you know, 5 years ago, if you were a top U.S. university, you still had to justify why you would want to get into open education. Like, there was this open courseware stuff and online learning and Twitter, you know, and you kind of had to like say, yes, it's going to help us with our mission, and we're going to reach more people, and the students want it. And, you know, it was like there was that conversation. Now, the conversation is the opposite. It's like, why are you not already involved in this? Why are you not already doing these things? Why are you not innovating, right? Like, it's moved past the point of, kind of arguing that we should be getting into this. it's now at the point where you have to have a position on this. Maybe you decide not to get into this. And I shouldn't say you, because maybe none of you work in universities, but if you are a university, yeah, there's a question there. I don't. So I'll give you my opinion, but I'm not an expert on K-6 or K-12. My impression after the EDU conference is that the K-12 space is much more locked down in terms of standardization and controls and policy and all of those things. That it'll be much harder to move kind of those really breakthrough ideas forward. I think Khan Academy. Interesting point to come back to. There's a lot of talk about Khan Academy and that video model, and I think it's worth interrogating that. But one of the interesting things that I think he has been able to do is with the flip the classroom idea, is that you really can change the way that those schools teach their students, and possibly at least in a different way that seems to be more engaging for some students. So I think there is room for this technology to have exactly the same disruptive effect at the K-12 level. I'm just a little more hesitant to say that it will do it, whereas at the university level, I think there's no question that this is going to move forward. There are some amazing people, like Butt the Teacher is some guy in that community. There's a science teacher who, what's the name of the guy who was tweeting the Sal Khan?
Dan Meyer.
Awesome. He's got a blog, and he's putting the things on there that he's doing with his students. It's really incredible. And so I think there's certainly a huge amount of innovation in that space. I think the there are structural reasons why they may be moving in a slightly different trajectory. What does this mean now, right? I think some people are freaking out. I think other people are looking at this as an opportunity. They're going, this is amazing. We're going to go with this. I think my personal opinion is I'm extremely excited about this. I think if you're in education, this is the best time, although I've been saying that every year for the last 5 years, that this is the best time to be in education, and it just gets better. But at the same time, I also have a lot of questions about this stuff. Right? So I want to spend a few minutes kind of setting up the conversation. I'm a little slower than I hoped I would be, but setting up the conversation about what are the things we should really be thinking about and keeping in mind as we consider moving into these massive online learning projects and communities. So what do we do? So one of the questions that we've been asking at P2PU is, if you take the online course and you look at what people have been doing with it, it's pretty uninspiring, largely. Right? It's usually you take the lecture model, which is uninspiring in the lecture hall, you move it online, and it's worse. So the starting point wasn't right. So we kind of looked at that, and we looked at the research on learning and stuff, and we were experimenting with something that we call challenges, which is really just problem-based learning online, and it works without a facilitator. And we've run some tests here for web developers, and kind of did a survey with the people who came through this and looked at all the analytics and prepared a little report on kind of figuring out how such a model could work online. I think we distilled some principles from this prototype that I think are useful to apply to these new online course models. And I'm going to briefly mention five areas that I would then love to talk about with everyone here. One is kind of the level of content. The other one is allocation of expertise. If you're a professor and you can reach maybe 20 people directly in a classroom, your classroom gets to a certain size where that becomes difficult. You hire a few TAs. But at 160,000 people, actually, I shouldn't go into the detail. Assessment, recognition, and community. So I think those are like kind of the five dimensions of this. And this is the dimensions are really based on conversations and work I've been doing with Steve Carson. And if we ever find the time to write that thing up, then it will appear in a Canadian journal in May, I think. Kind of an idea of what's the role of the professor, in the future. And so, open content. Just a few words to kind of get the ideas flowing, right? Largely video-based right now, but a huge degree of variation in the approaches to what's on those videos. And I think it's really worthwhile looking at the videos, and not just going, okay, it's video, but really looking at, well, how are these videos working, which ones are working more. And the nice thing is we have all the data because all of this stuff is hosted on YouTube. So all of us can go, and I do this frequently, go to these massive courses, click on the videos, you go to the YouTube site, you can see how many people watched it. Right? So you can compare which of these courses is doing best, where do people drop off. So you know all that data is available, and the people who own the videos actually have access to much more fine-grained analytics, so they can pay attention to what's working and what's not, and I think we'll get much better. And just one idea that came out of conversations the last few days, it seems like the videos that are working best are the ones that create a sense of intimacy, and often those are not the professionally produced ones. Like if it has that LA gloss, it creates a barrier between you and the video. But if it's kind of rough and the person loses their train of thought and they have to go through their notes, then it feels like you're sitting next to them and they're really talking to you. And those videos seem to work best. Allocating expertise. I started talking about this a little bit. The idea is that you can directly only reach a certain number of people. You can use technology to reach more, but it's a totally new way of reaching people that are in your courses. And these projects have experimented with things like office hours, where the World Regions course, for example, the office hours are streamed online, and anyone can submit questions using chats, and then the answers and the discussions, anyone can tune in from anywhere and watch the office hours. So it's not just one person in the office with the professors. It's one person's question in the office in front of a camera with, 10,000 people watching and listening to the answer. A lot of those courses hire online TAs, and I think, you guys also, right? Like you have it's a two-people operation, maybe a few more, but the fact that there are other people around the community that make things work is very, very important. And the online courses often have people kind of looking through the forums and making sure the community moves forward. And then you can use tools to kind of crowdsource what are the most pressing questions and then focus the attention of the professors or the experts on those questions. So the kind of feedback that I think is a little bit missing maybe in the discussions right now in these models is there isn't enough focus on peer-to-peer learning. There's a whole body of literature that says that peer-to-peer learning, the ability to form study groups, is the best way for people to learn, definitely at the institutional level. Like we have all this research from institutions, universities, but also I think enough kind of suggestion that works in interest-driven learning communities as well. And then secondly, building a mentoring aspect into these projects. Right? There's currently no way that you could actually reach out to someone. There's no way if you are an AI expert, you take that course, and you're willing to help someone who gets stuck. There's no way for you to say, hey, I'm a mentor, and if you get stuck, come talk to me, I'll help you through this stuff. And I bet there are lots of people, from our experience, about a third of the people that come through a P2PU course are willing to help someone else afterwards. So it's a huge number of people that you could potentially involve in this, and it's not being done. Assessment, huge, huge thing. I'm sure there'll be questions about this, so I might just skip through this, but this is what I think is kind of underwhelming assessment. You click on something, you get a little red cross, and it's not right. To be honest, I have no idea what should be in there, so I created that. This, I think, is kind of cooler assessment because you can actually do things and, you can manipulate, you can move things around, and it's like you're building something. And I think kind of the ideas around assessment, I think learning is making. So make the assessment part of that making process. Involve other people in it. Right? If you're collaborating with others, they'll know your level of competency. And build meaningful and rich assessments. Don't measure the things that are easiest to measure, which is always, I think, the first instinct, right? We can do multiple choice questions online electronically, so that's what we should do. And I think that's the wrong way. There is a role for that, but I think it's very limiting. recognition, they've taken different approaches. I've talked a little bit about this, so I'll skip through this. I think what I would love to get into this conversation of recognition is like recognizing different kinds of skills, you know, both higher order skills, 21st century skills, you know, choose your jargon, but not just hard skills. Pay attention to the motivation that people bring to these courses, and if you're rewarding them for the course, you may be messing with intrinsic motivation that you actually want to focus on the intrinsic motivation rather than add some kind of a reward that changes the reason why people participate. And I think it'll be a huge issue in these courses if you end up with communities of people who just want the piece of paper. Right? And I think there is a danger that that will happen. People who already are experts in these fields just want the piece of paper at the end coming through. You're not going to end up with a learning community. You're going to end up with a degree mill, run by the best universities in the world. And then community. So this is the last point I want to make. The most exciting thing for me about these large courses is what has happened unintentionally. So the AI course, these people, Reddit is kind of a community discussion platform site, and people who were in the AI course felt like the tools that they were offered, and I think in the beginning the platform wasn't working very well, they didn't really feel like they had a good space to talk to each other, so they just set up a group on Reddit. And that group has now, so not only did that group follow through the course, but it's now become basically a discussion community around other courses like this. Right? So it's almost like you've got, you know, a few thousand people now who are going to go on to the next course together. It's like a university, right? Except no one's in charge. And so I think that's really awesome to see that these kind of things happening around courses. This is, I guess, an older example that I wasn't even aware of until last night. But the Walter Lewin physics lectures at MIT, apparently, so while I watched the video, he is amazing at drawing lines on the blackboard, especially dotted lines. Like, he doesn't even stop. And so people have cut all the best scenes of him drawing lines on the blackboard out of all the videos he's made, and they've made this kind of best of, and it's incredible. And it's been watched by 153,000 times, which is just, you know. So these are the kind of things that I think say that there's a community aspect to these learning experiences. And for me and P2P University, of course, the community is the number one priority. So we're most interested in this. And I think two ways that you know, we could pay attention to this is, one is design for participation, right? So create the course materials in a way that encourages people to participate in this way, contribute their ideas, maybe add assessments. And then also, in terms of your platform, make sure that your platform enables this kind of stuff. Have open interfaces or APIs, or at least build linkages to other things that are happening elsewhere. So, you know, it's awesome that these people went off on Reddit, but wouldn't it, you know, you needed kind of people with a strong motivation to get that started. You know, you could make that a little bit easier if you're the provider of the course, and you'd see a lot of really awesome innovation happening around your courses, and then you could learn from that and bring that back into the course. So, you know, really use the community to learn about this experience. So, let's skip this. I have stickers, and I'm going to give them away to everyone who asks a question, or everyone who just wants a sticker and doesn't want to ask a question. So my suggestion would be, why don't we kind of throw the floor open a little bit for maybe just reactions and questions, and then I'm going to ask Steve and Audrey and whoever else wants to take a few minutes and speak, you know, about kind of their perspective on what's happening. So are there questions or reactions to this? There must be. Okay. We don't actually use an off-the-shelf tool. We've built a website in Django, which is a Python framework. But it's our tool is open source, so anyone could use it, and it is pretty much off-the-shelf. Very widely used tools are WordPress, which started as a blogging platform, but it's really grown into a content management system that has an amazing plugin community around it, so you can find plugins to extend it in numerous ways. You can also find lots of people who can help you build your WordPress sites. Like, there's a huge community of developers. So a lot of these courses use WordPress. In terms of the... So Ustream is kind of a streaming platform where, you know, you can broadcast yourself out into the web. That's something that's Twitter is, you know, very widely used as kind of the low level community building back channel. Almost everyone uses Twitter for these large courses. Many of the MOOCs run by the kind of larger institutions have a Q&A forum built in. There's a number of open source tools that you know, you could use. There's OSQA, which is basically a Stack Overflow clone. The MIT course uses something else, which is built on Django. You can actually go to the course and see the name of the project at the bottom. So those are some examples. There's Moodle, like the more traditional stuff, learning management systems. There's a, you know, variety of open source tools. Go ahead. That's an excellent question, and I think it'll be different scenarios for different teachers. I think there's certainly a role for people to be at Stanford and MIT to be running these courses. I mean, the goal for the original set of these courses was the campus students, right? So the initial idea was we're going to use all these tools, we're going to offer a more engaging experience to our students on campus. So those people will still be paid by the institutions, right? It's just kind of an externality almost that now the world can also participate in this and benefit from it. I think there is a model where you could see superstar teachers go outside of the institutions and just set up this one amazing course, and they could ask for donations, or they could offer certification and charge a small fee for the certification. There's an example in Brazil of an open courseware site that doesn't even offer real teaching. It's just the materials, and they have a few tests built in. And if you complete it, you can print out a certificate. And they don't charge, I think, right, FGV? They do. So they do charge even, and they've printed 1.2 million certificates. Right, so you can easily support an operation that has a few courses, you know, with a model like that. So I think that's one possibility. I think FGV. It's a law and business, private law and business university. They're in São Paulo and Rio, and they have an open courseware site. Yeah, go ahead. So I know that Steve would be a better... Do you want to talk about the MIT high school stuff?
Yeah, sure.
So maybe I'll hand over to Steve Carson, who has been involved in open courseware at MIT even before open courseware at MIT. He's got a project. Maybe then you just take over and talk a little bit about whatever you want to talk about.
Okay. Thank you. How many people here are familiar with MIT open courseware? So a little bit more familiarity there. So what we do, we don't create online learning environments, is basically, you know, one of the distinctions between us and what you're seeing here. What we do is we take classroom-based content and we publish it openly on the web so that anybody around the world can get to it. The original conception was that educators at other universities would download the materials and use it in their own classrooms. So what we did a couple of years ago, though, was we recognized that some of the materials we were publishing, we have materials from 2,100 of MIT's courses online. Some of the materials we were publishing were appropriate to advanced study at the high school level of physics, chemistry, biology, calculus, some of those subjects. And so we took the AP framework and we indexed pieces of our content to that framework, so that now you can go to our site and you can look, you know, if you're interested in physics and oscillations of pendulums and you want to see the video that we have on that. You don't have to watch all 40 or 50 of Walter Lewin's lectures to see that. You can just skip to the 43rd minute of the 15th lecture and you're right there. Boom. Or you can see the PDFs that we have on the site. So, I mean, there are some crossovers from higher education down into the K through 12 space. But again, like Philip, I'm not really an expert in that area, so I don't have any more information, I think, than he has on that. Sort of the one other observation that I wanted to make is that I really think that we're in a real place of a flux when it comes to the platforms that these things are being offered on. And in many ways, it sort of reminds me of the platform wars over the sort of traditional LMSs right now, and that's what you're seeing with Coursera over here and, you know, this and that and all these different things. But I do think that it's a different environment in that, you know, as we saw with the class size 3000 presentation, the tools are there. They're on the web. And an instructor can reasonably build one of these massive online courses just out of what's on the web right now. You can just adopt this and adopt that and grab this piece over here and put them all together. And, in fact, you can let learners do that for you. Learners will go out and select the tools that they think work best for them. So you're seeing two different kinds of platforms emerge. You're seeing the sort of complete platform that you get with an MITx or a Coursera or a Udacity. And you're also seeing these more fluid online learning communities or environments that are being created. We have a set of courses that we've created on our site, which, again, are just course content. They're not learning communities or learning experiences like these massive online courses, but we've set them up for independent learners so that they're set up. You can move through Unit 1, Unit 2, Unit 3 of the course materials. And there are a few of these sort of low-level assessments built in there, which are, you know, multiple choice questions and stuff. But what we're doing with those is then going out and finding best of breed in other areas. So there's a site called Open Study that we've been working with that is a forum, an exchange forum for students around the world to talk to one another. And we've connected that with our site. And we've found open textbook projects, and we've connected those open textbook projects with our projects. And so you don't need a business model necessarily for the whole package. Sometimes you just need a business model for your piece and to focus on your piece. Excuse me. Thanks. We had a question over here.
Yeah, I don't deserve a sticker because I just walked in the room.
You get a sticker anyways.
I only get a sticker if you didn't answer my question already. and I'm not going to give the lecture I just gave a couple days ago on this. Good pod. One can argue that the whole form of education today derives from a culture and the scalability problem from the 14th and 15th centuries. One can argue that the internet provides a way for kids or anybody to learn in a different way, not simply to translate this 14th, 15th century form onto the internet. Okay, so the question is whether these forms of basically figuring out how to move university textbook curriculum structure and the sage on the stage into the sage on the internet is really taking advantage of the technology and the opportunity that's represented by the internet to do things that's quite different. And if anyone wants a, and this is the shame, this is Alpi, so this is a shameless plug, except I'm not selling it. If you want to look at an alternative to this, I run a site called Wybill, which has 7.2 million children in it, and we have been designing curriculum which assumes the kids are embedded in the simulation-based, games-based virtual world, where the curriculum that's in the schools, where the teachers are actually doing, assumes that, builds around that. And I think what you'll find if you look at that and several other projects that are sort of like that that are coming is that it may be the core structure of this whole thing is not really what we should be doing, and figuring out the patch at the moment might not be, well, the reason to do it, it may not be in the long run the path to the solution.
Sure. So I think, was that a reaction? Was that a reaction to this?
Comment from before.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. And you should give me a sticker because that will increase my intrinsic motivation.
You get two stickers.
No, no, no. It can't be too many.
No, it was a surprise.
Oh, okay. Then I'm extra. Thank you. I just had to. Everybody was talking about the stickers. I was really excited when you had assessment up on one of your slides and then disappointed to see that the only assessment you spoke about was content knowledge assessment. And we're talking about a lot of stuff here. We're talking about OpenCourseWare, we're talking about peer-to-peer, we're talking about social learning. And I think we're doing ourselves a disservice by not measuring our outcomes. The way I see it is this. You're spending a lot of time building something, right? Spend a little extra time and assess it, right? Assess the learning outcomes. So, for instance, you mentioned earlier the Twitter is a back channel in a classroom. We have data to show that that does nothing for student engagement and nothing for their content level retention. I mean, so that's just the point. I don't know if that's a question.
Was that? Yeah, I wasn't sure that. So, are these directly related to this? Because I'm dying to reply, but do you?
I think it's related to that. I was going to mention the same thing, which is, I think the assessment is very important, but not looking at it from the academia side, academic side, but looking at it from the other side, which is, there's two reasons why you study. One is for the joy of learning. The other one is because you want a different job. You want to be able to do something different, right? So the question is, if I am a company who's trying to hire, like you said in this example, developers, right? How could you help me to understand which people are good? Because then I'll start using that, and that'll turn into a virtuous circle, right? And I guess the top 1% of 160,000 students is still a very small sliver. Maybe there are potentially more students that are capable of it.
Yeah, I think so. There were two more hands. There was one up there and there's one there. Do you guys want to get in now or do you want to let Andre go first? I think we're going to stay on this topic for a while. So maybe why don't you go jump
in
here.
I mean, this is actually one of the things that fascinates me with all of the excitement we've seen in the media over the Stanford AI class and the Stanford machine learning class and this notion that we have hundreds of thousands of informal learners taking advantage of a pseudo-formal learning situation. And as I sort of have thought and talked with folks who took these classes, most of the people were already experts in that field. Most of the people who successfully completed the machine learning class in my informal talking with data scientists were already data scientists. And for them, it was sort of like another notch on their belt, but it really wasn't. They were not novices taking an introductory class in machine learning. For them, this was very much, can I pass the bar that Sebastian Thrun has set for his AI class? And I'm seeing that now. I'm taking the his introduction to CS class, which by the end of 7 weeks, I'll be able to build a search engine. So if you want to invest in my new company now, it's going to be awesome. But I don't know how to program, and I'm finding myself sort of far behind the rest of my fellow students in the class who are Python software developers for a living, but are taking the class because they get a piece of paper from Sebastian Thrun that says, you can build a search engine. And so I wonder how much of what's happening with those particular classes are very, very different than the other things that we're seeing in P2PU. In fact, when I was struggling to learn to program, one of the folks who actually reached out to me was a real life human from P2PU and said, "Hey, I'll help you. I'll work with you. Let's work on this together if you really want to learn how to code." And it seems like a very different model than signing up for something and then finding yourself in a online system which isn't really about teaching you anything. It's about assessing how much you know.
So there are two more things up there, two more contributions. And I just want to say very briefly, I agree with everything that you three said. I wish we'd had more time to talk about assessment because I think it is the most interesting thing in this space right now. I do think that there, and I'm I hope that wasn't the perception. I do think that a focus on a content, general focus on a lecture model or content delivery model is completely the wrong way for helping people learn something. Learning has to be focused on solving problems that are meaningful to people. It has to be social. It has to involve making something. Right? So the philosophy of learning that we have at PDPU is very much aligned to everything you said. So I just wanted to make sure that there's no misunderstanding here. We've got two more people. Let's get them in the conversation, and then also we can stay longer if people want to stay longer or in a smaller group. And maybe just before I hand over. It would be awesome if anyone who wants to continue the conversation or even just wants to stay kind of up to date with what's happening with these MOOCs, just drop me an email. I'm kind of putting together a bookmark list on this topic, and you know, I'll be sharing some updates regularly. So if you want to stay in touch, you know, please reach out. But there's a lady there, and then there's someone up there.
Well, I would say that in terms of classes that aren't based on the lecture, this is something that's interesting to me as well. Seeing that, of course, the Stanford class and the MITx, not surprisingly, these are all technology classes, and I have to wonder, as someone whose background is not in technology, what does it look like when you scale a class of several hundred thousand people and you're learning something else that really fits, that's really doesn't necessarily fit into the multiple choice assessment, that's really not often a lecture-based class. When I taught it, I taught literature, which doesn't really work well in lecture-based setting. I mean, I suppose it could. We all know those teachers. But ideally, and so I think that there's still a lot of questions out there. I would say that I would point again to Jim Groom and DS106, which is his digital storytelling class at Mary Washington, is a great example of a massive class that's not at all sort of oriented around lecture and very much not oriented around the multiple choice assessment. It's about making things.
And maybe one thing that he actually said in a session earlier, he said that you have to kind of give up control. And then amazing stuff, you have to allow amazing stuff to happen. And it's kind of this stuff, you kind of put enough in that people understand how they can contribute, but then you have to also be comfortable kind of wow, what's happening? So with badges, it's a big topic. I think badges are primarily interesting because the assessment and accreditation systems that we have needed a jolt. Right? We needed a reason to ask questions about them. Like they've been kind of stuck for a long time, and they were going in the wrong direction as we're trying to scale up multiple choice assessments. And so for me, badges are almost like a conversation starter, right? Where you can get people to think differently around both assessment and recognition and certification. With respect to using badges to motivate learning, I think it's something that we have to be very cautious with. It's exactly for the extrinsic motivation reasons. I don't totally agree with the people that say, you know, the moment you add anything, you're messing with the intrinsic motivations. I don't think it's that simple.
The research doesn't bear that out.
Well, some of them suggests that, right?
It depends on the size of the reward. Timing.
Absolutely.
That's why, yeah. I mean, I wasn't joking about just giving me one sticker. Right? I mean, that's better than giving me two.
So,
I guess, so you're making my point for me. This exact question needs more work. Like, we're not totally sure how to use badges in learning to incentivize the kind of learning that we would like to see happening, which is, you know, constructive and participatory. And so I think I'm certainly not a badges evangelist, but I do think that it's a great way to get us moving from better assessments and better certification systems than what we have today.
Can I suggest an exercise for the class?
For this class?
Yeah, our professor too. So when you're alone...
You're now in the class.
Well, you have been, right? So you should be, right? Anything that's good is actually fun. So when you're at home tonight, think about the consequences of the technical characteristics of the printed book for the way we think about all of this. For example, you talked about assessment. It is because of the printed book that assessment takes place at the end of the chapter. It's also because of the printed book that at some point you end up getting a badge at the end of something. In a real third grade classroom with a real third grade teacher, assessment takes place continuously as does some form of badging. This kind of technology actually allows assessment to take place continuously. But what we're trying to do is pour it into this technology, what people are trying to do is pour it into something basic function of printing press. There are a lot of other features of printing presses that have deeply influenced our educational system. For example, who says physics and biology are separate subjects? The only reason they're separate subjects is because one had to put one of them in one book and one of them put one in another book. And there's no way to cross-link the two subjects as in book form. And then you get the Department of Physics and the Department of Biology, and they don't want to talk to each other. And you've got a physics course in biophysics and biology, and you've got a physics course in biophysics and physics, and they don't talk to each other. This whole thing, I think, a huge amount of our structure is not supposed to be the wrong technology to teach humans. Okay. One last point, and I'm already giving a lecture on my apologies. I'm a neurobiologist. Okay, and I'm a modeler. I build models of the brain. And neurobiologists are slowly converging on some basic understandings. There's a lot of debate and arguments about how human learning works. It turns out they should have read Plato. Because actually, Socrates had it pretty right, even in terms of sort of deep understanding of how brains work. So the point I want to make is I think we got sidetracked because we didn't have the right technology in the 14th and the politics and the whatever, and now is the time to really change that. I think we really have to be aware of the technology we're in and why we're in it and question it all to figure out. This last point. Motivation. Talking about motivating primates to learn is like talking about motivating ants to carry things back to their homes and their jaws. If you have to exert an external form of motivation to a primate, then one of two things has happened. Either the educational system has removed their own internal structure for motivation somewhere along the line, or you're not doing things right.
Are there any other questions?
I'll go quickly. I actually completely disagree with that point, but I'm not in education, so I probably don't get it.
Which is why you should be an educator.
I'm curious where large institutions like MIT and Stanford are breaking ground on this. Have you seen government or business approach you guys about applying the same learning and learning sharing models to training employees, training on programs that are intrinsic to not education for education's sake, but education for top line revenue growth, margins.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. There was a gentleman here from IBM, the session I spoke at this morning, that was talking about one of their biggest concerns right now is that in 10 years there's not going to be the talent they need out there to support their labor pool. And I've actually been talking with another company recently who is creating an open education site that is intended to help people in developing countries to develop the basic skills they need to hold a job, to understand what it means to hold a job, to put together a resume, to learn how to work in groups. And they're going to do it completely open. They're going to help these people to develop these skills regardless of whether they actually come and work for this particular company or not, because they recognize the dire need to get these people trained up to the point. And this is all pre-training before they bring them in as hires and actually start paying them and train them on how to be in this particular company. So there's a lot of that out there.
We actually have someone, I think, who you want to respond, right? Or
no?
You want to ask a question? Then we had someone out there first. This is a good opportunity.
Do you guys have any examples of people using MOOCs to introduce college to first-generation college students as opposed to people who may be already interested in, like, elite schools like MIT or Stanford?
That's my point exactly, actually. I think the most exciting thing about all the educational stuff we're talking about is, quite frankly, getting other people who are not in the university system at all involved. I'm terribly excited about that. I think we should have courses online for free in plumbing and in welding and in international affairs. It should all be out there. And we'll figure out how to make it count for somebody down the road. That part interests me. Actually, not at all.
And I don't know
about getting the information out there.
Sorry. I don't know about MOOCs in particular, but I do know that one of the big values that we've been able to document in OpenCourseWare, just putting the course content up, is that it's a strong motivator for getting people to return to higher education. If you know they dropped out or they had some problems, it helps them develop the confidence. And for students who've never been or first-generation students, they can develop the confidence that they'll be able to succeed at the higher education level through looking at this material.
I would say, too, that some of the things like Open Study, which bring together communities of people that aren't necessarily on campus working together to work and study, sort of at a 24-hour-a-day online, you can always find someone who's taking Introduction to Algebra. I think it's that sort of social support network that's really important, particularly for those who are sort of new to higher ed.
We're being cut off.
Yeah, I have a separate question.
Okay.
Yeah. My name is Hans de Zwart. So I've been participating in some MOOCs, especially the kind of the Stephen Downs, George Siemens ones. And the one thing that I find a little bit puzzling, and I don't know who has thought a bit better about it than me, is kind of the aspect of repeatability of these things. So a lot of people here, I assume, have been teachers. I have been as well. I was always struck at the different levels of quality that you would reach with the same course, depending on who was in the course, how you feel, how much you adjusted things. Certain small changes make it suddenly not work. And if I look at the differences between what they're trying to do at Stanford, it seems like they're trying to scale instead of this massively repeatable thing that just... and I wonder what you lose in the ability to really do it again every year. And is that possible and sensible with a MOOC? Yeah? So the next group is going to find so much from the last group as well. That's also a thing.
Respond to 200,000 students. I mean, I think that John and Katie have sort of. I mean, I think you do an excellent job of responding to 3,000 students, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure it's possible at all. Sort of be flexible, and I think you're right. I mean, I think that when they're talking about scaling out education, it is the copy paste version of this course. We'll do it once. We'll put it online, and everyone will move through it.
No, I want to add something. I think this is interesting. So I guess I'm a little more optimistic that we can figure out ways to scale learning that is not the kind of, delivery, watch the video, answer the multiple choice question, but that we can ask really engaging questions and we can define really interesting problems, and then we can give people just enough help that they get started and they start working on their own, and we put them together with other people who are exploring that same trajectory and who will kind of put mechanisms in place where they start helping each other, offer mentoring if they need it. And actually, so coming back to the way that I would say people have always learned, which is through apprenticeship, through observing, through copying, right? Through joining a community of other people who have certain norms and values and practices and observing those. And so I think this is an opportunity actually to go back to a really wonderful way of learning across, you know, a huge spectrum of topics. And but I do agree with all the remarks about the way that this is going right now. I am worried that we will end up in kind of a commodification of, you know, where it's all about the scale, it's all about, you have to hit, you know, it was important for MITx to hit 100,000 signups. You know, 100,000 signups for a university course, it's just ludicrous, right, that you would even, kind of, people would expect you to sign up 100,000 people. So, but I'm very hopeful, and I think that people like us can build a future using these technologies and these ways of, you know, that we conceptualize learning that will actually be amazing. I checked with the other person, and he said we could stay until the new panelist arrives. Well, I think yes and no. I think there are some amazing people in universities, both in leadership positions and in kind of, you know, professors who are doing amazing stuff, and they're in it for the right reasons. I do think that people, largely people involved in the university enterprise, are in it for the right reasons. And the institution has shifted in a direction that I think is the wrong direction. But I think the people involved are still in it for the right reasons. And I think this could be a way to kind of offer them an alternative to what the institution is, you know, going into. And I think we will see what people refer to as disruptive innovation, right? The same with the music industry and these other industries. The education system will change. And it'll be,
Look, I just wanted to make a comment. I think that there's a question up here regarding, is there anybody else doing it? I'm not part of the educational system. I work with startups right now before I used to have a very large number of people in the lecture faculty. And one area where we're struggling a lot with this kind of thing is inside the companies. Because, of course, you have the filter where you hire graduates into the companies, but just to impress to you, you know, the problem, right? You have 300,000 people, for example, at a company like where I was at HP. And you want to have a succession plan, and you want to have people development and all those things. And there's practically no structures in there. So structures like peer-to-peer learning, mentorship, and, you know, people coming with grassroots, that could be something that we could talk more about, because it could also potentially be an interesting angle. And the reason why it's interesting is because if it catches there, then it's very easy to go downstream into the universities, because these are the people who are hiring a bunch of people into it, right? So when you think about accreditation, you can go two ways. You can go more the official, this is an MIT thing, which is known as the official channel, or you can go the unofficial way, which you start using it inside by the employees and the managers and the people development inside the companies. And once you start opening that up, especially if you create a permeable environment for leadership skills, for different kinds of things, you could say, hey, I know Roberto. Yeah, he was in some of the classes, he has participated. You know, we need a new product manager. Why don't you talk to the guy? And then, you know, the whole barrier of what kind of university degree do you have becomes a little bit less important, which is really what happens, right? I mean, I've hired many, many people during my career, and, you know, it's not that important. Once you get them, you know, it's just basic stuff what you get. The rest you have to build inside the company.
Yeah, so I think very good points. I think it would be fascinating to start some of these innovations within very large corporations because they might be able to move faster. But I think there are similar structural reasons why corporations may not be a great place to work with, because there will be a different mindset that may not be open to the experimentation and, you know, some of those ideas. And then there's a whole range of subjects that are probably not as relevant to the corporations, you know, the arts, the humanities, which I think are often overlooked in these when things come to technology-driven projects. So But I think for accreditation, and that's we've worked with Mozilla for one of the reasons why we worked with them was for this reason. You can build an alternative accreditation system if you have someone who's got reputation in a particular area, HP, right? It opens possibilities, which if P2PU started issuing certificates, they will have some value in a certain community. Well, it'll take a long time for that to, you know, disseminate and diffuse into other communities. And maybe one last thing, which actually connects back to the assessment thing, is one of the interesting things when we looked at web developer training and what are the skills that are important and what should we reflect to employers, we looked at LinkedIn recommendations that web developers would write for each other. So not employers writing about their staff, but it, like, I'm your friend, like we're peers, I'm writing you a recommendation. We can trust those recommendations as good statements of what those people really care about and what they think the employer is important for the employer. And what was interesting is the technical stuff is totally just assumed. It's like, you know, whatever language they're working on. And then everyone just writes about he's a great team member. He really understands functional requirements and can translate them into code. He can explain technical things to other people he works with or she works with, right? So it's all the soft stuff. And a university degree, there's no room for any of that. Like there's no thing that says great team player. And so the employers actually, there is a good opportunity here to come build better assessments for the kinds of things we care about, then reflect them maybe through badges or other mechanisms, and then show that the employers care about this and, you know, kind of see what the accreditation system of the future could look like. Anyway, I think we're at the end of the session. This was really wonderful for me. I appreciate all the questions and the comments. And please be in touch by email or Twitter or something. And thank you. And have a great South by Southwest. And I do want to thank Steve Carson and Audrey Waters specifically. I roped them into this. They were game for coming up here and helping me do this. So thank you, guys.